Hello, everyone. This is the In the Crease podcast. I am your co-host, Dan Abern, joined in person this time by Kyle Devitt. He's right here.
Yeah.
So I can simultaneously see the disdain on his face whenever I say something instead of some pixelated version of his face. Kyle, I have fantastic news.
What is that?
It's officially March Madness. We had Selection Sunday this past Sunday. The NCAA basketball tournament will be starting soon, which means that all men's basketball programming will be moving to the CBS family of networks. And amazingly, this means that going forward, there will be a lot more lacrosse on television. It's all falling into place, Kyle.
That is the title of this episode. It's all falling into place. Thankfully, I was able to tear my eyes away from the blistering action of the Mustang Classic to watch some leftovers of D1 all day Sunday, just so I can be ready for the madness of this podcast. Are we ready?
All right, let's go to Saturday, though. The marquee game of the weekend, at least in terms of hype, was Yale versus Cornell. Big tilt in the Ivy League. Yale came away with this one 16-11 over Cornell.
Yeah, I think sometimes you watch games and a single quarter is indicative of how the entire game will play out. And I think that was the case here, is Yale's dominance of the first quarter was really a microcosm of the entire game. They took away Cornell's strengths, feeding the inside and catching teams changing in early offense, and also beat the Big Red in transition. Essentially, it looked like kind of at one point a body swap movie where Yale was a team that kept hitting the inside man instead of Cornell. I think Yale also recognized that Connor Fletcher is a huge part of that Cornell offense and chose to pull him and slide off of everyone else. Yale's D-mids also had great games, and Cornell's D-mids did not. But the star for me was Jack Starr. I worded that badly on purpose. It looked like Cornell's scout was to shoot five hole on him, and they did score a couple goals like that later on, but he was sprawling for the entire first half and making great saves and seeing the ball very well. And a few of Cornell's automatic goals against most goalies were not automatic against him. Talking about Yale, the team that won, I think Yale's a team that adapts to beat their next opponent better than anyone in college lacrosse. Tactically, they're such a superior team with so many multi-skilled players to call upon. It's a credit to the coaching staff, who not only have great schemes, but recruit versatile first-team players and starters, and also build guys from the bench to be able to contribute.
Yeah, after watching Cornell twice in 3 days last weekend, I thought this game was going to go the way their game against Penn State did, and rather than the game against Towson did, and because you're facing a team who's got a clear advantage at the faceoff X, and they also have an offense that can really give you fits. And that's pretty much how this one played out. TD Erland bossed it 24-30 at the X, and I think really importantly, Yale cleared 18 of 20, didn't let that nasty Cornell ride that really befell Towson get to them. They got those critical saves early from Jack Starr, and like you said, it seemed to throw Cornell's offense off the rhythm. And then Yale just has a lot of guys you have to cover, especially when they're on. Matt Brandau and Brian Tevlin were particularly great in this game, and just proof that they can get scoring past the known commodities. But speaking of known commodities, of course, Matt Gaudette just finishes about everything that's thrown his way.
And stuff on the ground.
Yeah, and stuff. Yeah. Just a wizard. Jeff Teat with just a goal and an assist in this game, and it seemed like they almost used him as a distraction to pull out Chris Fake and open things up for others, and Piatelli in particular. I think 4 goals, 2 assists here, because it really seemed like Teat didn't really challenge him when he lined up against him, didn't test that matchup. And then, like you said, Yale keying in on Connor Fletcher was also pertinent to point out. That big downhill dodging play they run is such a staple of their offense, get everybody moving and such. Do you think, though, that is accurate? Do you feel like they said, let's just let Chris Fake key on Jeff Teat and kind of play, not necessarily 5-on-5, but...
Well, they said on the broadcast that, you know, Fake wanted the matchup. And I, you know, sometimes coaches say stuff to people calling the game, and it's kind of like maybe a little bit of misdirection in there. But I think this was pretty genuine. I think he really wanted to crack at him. I don't think he did well against Grant Ament when they played earlier in the year. I was there for that game. And I think he probably just, you know, has a lot of pride and is a really good defender and wanted, you know, a shot at Teat. and a shot to shut him down. And, you know, kind of did that, I think. You know, I bet Teep probably had two or three hockey assists, if we were counting those. But, yeah, I think Piatelli coming from behind the cage and finishing all those balls was incredible for them. But it just was so little, so late, because Yale kept striking them in transition, too.
Yeah, it's just a pretty convincing Yale victory, it feels like.
Absolutely.
Like, we know that, like, we talked about this last week, but if Cornell gets the ball, they will score. But it felt like they got a lot of their goals pretty late in the game after it felt like this one was decided. So let's move on to the funnest game of the weekend, Kyle, maybe?
D1, I'll give you that.
Okay, okay. Syracuse 18, Rutgers 14.
I want to start by saying that Brendan Curry is gross. This was one of those games where Q supporters totally flipped back to the light side of the dome gods, threw themselves at the mercy, threw themselves at their feet, and kind of just decided to fall over themselves with praise of, it seemed like, every single player on the roster on Twitter. But out of all those, like, this player is underrated, this player doesn't get enough love takes, which, let's be honest, some of them were questionable at best, I think the most deserving was Brendan Curry is a top midfielder in the country. Is he the number one midfielder? I don't know. But you'd have a hard time convincing me that he's not top three. What do you think?
I think he's playing at a first-team All-American level right now. He's certainly one of the best dodging midfielders in the country because of the blitzing speed and the tremendous first step. His confidence level is through the roof right now. I couldn't imagine how good that midfield could be if Dordovic was not out. But, you know, I do think that he is a top midfielder in the country, and I think the only other guy that we might include in the conversation as the best would be Dox right now, who had a big game in Virginia's win. We'll talk about that. But, you know, I know there's a lot of love for Brett Kennedy, too. I think he's great. I definitely think that he is an All-American caliber LSM. And I actually was thinking this. I want your take on this. He's a great two-way LSM. I feel like we're kind of losing the two-way LSM these days.
No, I don't buy two-way LSM. I buy there's a school of thought of people that are like, the LSM is the marquee position going forward, and it's gotten more development in the past 10 years than anything except the face-off. And I ascribe to that partially. I think that guys like Scott Ratliff really pushed the position into being a more offensive weapon. And I mean, the Scott Ratliff is so good, he was handling the ball late in MLL games as part of the offense on purpose at the top of the box to try and draw out another defender so everyone else could play 5-on-5. That's not happening right now. He's not at that level. I don't think anyone's at that level. But I think it's super important if you are a pole that handles the ball. And by the way, poles are handling the ball more this season than probably in the history of lacrosse because of the shot clock and especially the clear clock, actually. So I think that if you can't do that, you stand out. And he doesn't stand out in the way that he can't do that. And when he does get a chance to run upfield, he makes good decisions with the ball, and he makes good decisions staying on and off, which I think is actually the key to the position.
Okay. What did we think of Rutgers in this game?
Yeah, man, Rutgers scored on a lot of broken plays. I think that's down to their scrappy nature, which is basically the adjective people use to describe Rutgers for like a decade.
They're scrappy.
Yeah. It's almost like a backhanded compliment. I think there's a ton of offensive skill on the Scarlet Knights. Sherilyn Bides, Casey Rose, and Kira Mullins are all incredible. Not good, incredible. They lean so hard on Edelman, though, on the defensive side to bail them out of games. Although, wait, Dan, the last team that leaned heavily on an Edelman won a Super Bowl, so maybe we're onto something here.
Gross. Ew.
I'm wearing the shirt, too. Look, what does it say?
Bet against us.
Don't bet against us. That's what it says.
Oh, don't bet against us. We're still here. You're right. Mullins and Sherilyn Bides are outstanding offensive players, and I actually was blown away by how good some of the finishes by Sherilyn Bides in this game were. Just makes, like we said, makes the absurd look easy. I feel like the Rutgers D, like you said, leaned on Edelman way too much, like leave out to dry lean, even though he had a huge save late in the game. But it felt like the game was out of reach with the very hashtag Dome Gods play with Voight falling down and like passing the ball backhanded to Lipka for a score. I feel in the absence of Michael Rexroad, the Rutgers defense just has not been what we've expected this season and are leaning on Edelman way too much, especially the last three games where they've let leads slip in the fourth quarter. I mean, 57 shots by Syracuse is crazy, and any goalie is going to crack and give up 18 against nearly 60 shots.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to figure out Rutgers, though, because they're 4-4. They've lost two straight against Lehigh, who's a hot team right now, and now Syracuse. Their Princeton win lost steam with Princeton falling to Penn this weekend. Princeton's at 2-4 now. They are once again back in that position where they need to hit some home runs in conference play in order to get themselves back in the postseason conversation. Because I think they're, like you said, their offense is certainly good enough to consider them a top 20 team right now. I voted them in the last tier of my top 20, even though they are on the schneid right now. But I look at the abilities that Mullins and Sherlin Vita as Casey Rose have, and they also have a decent amount of depth of scoring there, too. I just think that there's talent here, but it has not translated yet into victories.
Did not put them in my top 20.
Okay. Sorry.
Like them. Don't love them.
All right, Kyle. Next game, Virginia 13, Notre Dame 11. An interesting one.
So I wanted to talk about this real quick. Someone asked me on Twitter. I'm sorry I don't have your name in front of me, but I told you it would be on the podcast, and now it is. Someone asked me if Laviano was the best off-ball finisher in lacrosse. And I think it depends. He had 5 goals in this game. I think it depends on what you mean by that. But if you're talking about a guy who can shots to the far pipe from inside 10 yards, Laviano's that guy. But then you have to think about Clark Peterson, Matt Gaudette, Mac O'Keefe, who I think has the most range, and of course, Bradley Voigt. You could make a chart of guys where they're most effective on the field, and the chart would just be this red glowing heat map of goals around the crease out to 10 yards out. But I want to bring this up to highlight Laviano's importance, not only in this game where he dropped, again, 5 goals, but to Virginia's we only go fast offense. Virginia is so good at slipping picks and floating to the back pipe. I mean, all their attackmen do what you're supposed to do every time someone drives. They get open. And that's a real skill in lacrosse. It's so important. It can be your only skill. And when you match that with the ability to finish anything, you're an incredible player. You have great stats. You have a lot of goals.
Yeah. I can't believe you didn't mention Kevin Lindley for Loyola, though. Like, dude is averaging 4 goals a game and is practically a third arm for Patrick Spencer, just scoring all of his goals that he could otherwise score. I actually think a high-level off-ball finisher has been a really prominent constant in Sean Kerman offenses. I mean, yep. I think of Mike DeMario the past 2 seasons for Virginia, who was so critical as a scorer, but I felt like criminally underrated, didn't necessarily get a lot of the love. And then I think of Kyler Bellistri in that Dynamite Brown offense back in 2016 and 2015 and how crucial he was. But, you know, Laviano had a bit of a shaky start to this season, but he has really come on strong, especially in the last 4 or 5 games, and has really taken on that off ball, you know, wing shooter, inside finisher, whatever you want to call that kind of role that I really feel like a lot of Virginia's success has, you know, hinged upon the past 2 or 3 seasons. What do we think about Notre Dame, though? This interesting.
I don't think that this was a horrible loss for them. You know, I think Notre Dame actually did a really great job of exploiting the Virginia 2 slide, which was basically non-existent and is what teams will keep doing forever or until Virginia defenders figure out who the 2 is. And that's just plays where the first slide actually showed up. Like, lots of great ball movement for the Irish and a really encouraging sign despite the loss. If you're looking for something good to focus on and you're a Notre Dame fan, that's the number one thing. I mean, Notre Dame is really good at hitting the open man and finishing. That is not something that I think you can say about Notre Dame for the past 10 years that they've been really good at. Like, they've had a lot of creation there when they had Matt Kavanaugh driving up on the right side, going lefty, trying to find the guys inside, Mikey Wynn finishing. But I think this year they have so much more variation in their player style that they can dodge from multiple points and also are really good in the two-man and exploiting, you know, defense's weak points.
Yeah, I agree. I felt like the ball movement looked really good. And it's just funny. Like, now I'm thinking about it. If you take this game and the Maryland game in isolation, you would say that Notre Dame's strength is their offense and not necessarily their defense, which Has that ever been the case ever in the history of the universe?
No.
No. So that's crazy.
In any sport.
So if you don't...
I'm just kidding. Don't come at me, Notre Dame football fans. I don't want to hear it.
To me, this is a really under-the-radar win for Virginia. This is a matchup that Virginia has been notoriously snake-bitten in and has gone significantly in the favor of Notre Dame over the years. I think of, like, the Sergio Perkovic walk-off from, like, a million yards away a few years ago to John Sexton, like, causing the two turnovers in the last minute of the game last year. I mean, think about this win. Virginia is down 10-5 halfway through the third quarter. Seven straight goals for the Virginia offense, and then an icer from Doc Saikin that was so fast that the slow-mo cameras couldn't even pick out the ball. Like, that ball disappeared and went into the goal.
Yeah.
Virginia quietly 2-0 in the ACC.
So
a little crazy.
While we were prepping for this pod, Dan was rewatching highlights, and we were talking about one of the other goals in the game first, right? Which goal were we talking about?
The
last goal for Notre Dame. And I was like, just wait for it. And you were like, what do you mean? I'm like, just wait for Doc Saikin's big goal. And it's notable because it basically comes out of nothing.
Yeah.
Like, most people wouldn't even think about shooting through a guy, catching the pass and turning and letting it go. And he did it. And it was so hard and so fast that there was almost no reaction from anyone on the field. And like you said, not even capture on camera. Just an incredible goal. It was incredible.
So I like, quick aside, but you know, now that you see me watch like highlights in real life, how would you describe I react to like plays like that? Because so, I feel like it's me watching like a fight where like an Instagram fight where a dude gets like knocked out. You're like, ooh.
Yeah. So guys, if you don't know Dan Ayburn, here's Dan Ayburn's defining characteristic. If he is watching anything, he physically reacts to what he's watching. So I will say though, you physically react to pretty much anything and everything. So if he's scrolling through Twitter and he sees something funny, it's not a chuckle, folks. It's a full-blown cacophony of laughter echoing throughout the Inside the Cross offices. And just so you guys know, when I come down here, Dan and I share an office, and there is a weird buzzing that happens in the office, and Dan doesn't notice it anymore. And it's all I can think about when we're sitting there trying to do our work. And I'll just look up and be like, how do you not hear that? And then he doesn't answer me because he's got headphones in and he's laughing at something else. It's wild, folks. It's wild here at the IL offices. I'm just pulling back the curtain for you guys.
Yeah, that's a well-placed criticism of me, yes.
I don't know if it's a criticism, but it's a characteristic.
It's a characteristic, I'll say that. It's very, very, very apt, though. All right, Kyle, next game we've got Duke 12, Towson 10 on the dirt fields of Koskinen.
All right, so why does Duke play on actual dirt instead of turf or grass? There are hundreds, maybe thousands, of soccer teams in Europe that can keep their pitch green year-round. And you're telling me that Duke, the Duke, can't do that. I'm only half kidding. But
it's been raining a lot in North Carolina.
But I think the ground actually did affect parts of the game. Whenever players made hard cuts, they slid out a little. And more often than not, the players that slipped were Towson guys. Is it a conspiracy? No. But I wish it was.
Yeah. So this actually kind of seemed to be a theme of the whole weekend. But shooters were hot in this game. Yeah. Lots of crazy like highlight goals, like stinging corners left and right. The state of the pitch did seem to affect things. I think in particular the Seau goal where he gets a step on Goodrich, and I'm like, that just does not happen, it seems. But I thought Towson sort of had Duke for a bit here, but just let things get away. Like, Duke ran really well in transition and actually hurt Towson in a spot that they're usually good at so far this season. And I thought that this was a pretty impressive display from Towson's half-field offense, even though they lost, especially after the Cornell game, where they just seemed to not get anything going when they really needed to respond to the run that Cornell was having. Two straight losses for Towson now, but I feel like this result is sort of encouraging. Like, you go on the road and you lose by two to a team that, you know, last week pretty much annihilated Loyola. And
I mean, in terms of the game itself, I think We saw the one place I think you're right about the transition, but I think we saw Towson falter a little when it came to 50-50 balls. Like, the stats are close. Duke finished with 31. Towson finished with 26 as a team. But the difference is that the Tigers rely on winning ground ball battles. It helps to them to impose their will upon their opponents. Like, we all know Duke is talented, but how many people outside of actual Blue Devil fans knew that Duke was also gritty and grimy and could just get down with a team like Towson?
Yeah.
That's what we saw here. And that's that, to me, that's, it's another feather in the Duke cap. As much as, like, people want to hate on Duke, like, they are legit off the ground and they will mess you up.
Well, I think Duke is very chameleon like. They can adapt. They always have the personnel to kind of mimic or take on different styles and such like that. And I think that's what we saw here with Towson. I really want to fight against this narrative now because Towson's lost two straight. People are probably kind of sailing them down the river. I want to fight this narrative that Towson doesn't belong because Towson is a good team. Like, I think this team could absolutely make a Final Four.
So Towson's, this is, sorry to bring in a D3 talk. So if you don't like this, like, skip forward. Towson's comp in D3 is York. So York is highly valued, right? They are a very good team, but they lost to a team like RIT who just flat out had more talent, had more panache, a little bit more flair, and a little bit more forward thinking, even though York, just like Towson, is one of the most drilled teams. Like, they are an excellent, excellent team. Coach Childs has them ready to battle, just like Coach Natalin has Towson ready to battle for all the games. Sometimes you don't win all the battles you need to win the war. And I think that's just what's happened to Towson the last couple games. But, yo, I just wanted to bring this up one more time. Remember last week when Brad Smith and Cade Van Rapphorst didn't get drafted by the MLL? That was hilarious.
Yeah, yeah.
That was really funny.
Kyle, moving on to some briefer recaps of games. Let's go into the scoreboard. Johns Hopkins 12, Delaware 10.
I want to start out this section of the scoreboard recap by saying something very positive about Hopkins.
Whoa.
You all right?
My knees are... Whew.
I know. I love their old school helmet decals.
Okay, because I don't. But
really?
Yeah.
Oh, you youngins. I think you need to be like an old team with a lot of tradition to rock them, but they look so, so good with the new helmets. And I'm going to throw in a real compliment. I thought Hopkins actually looked pretty good despite a couple stallouts on their offense, especially in the first half, and then coming back in the fourth to absolutely ice it. What did you think?
Well, I think this is like a low-key good win for Hopkins.
Delaware's good.
Delaware came this game 6-1. You know, they have a great goalie in DeLuca, who was pretty good in this game. Delaware had a two-goal lead in the fourth, and, you know, Hopkins really leaned on their veterans late. They showed up, especially the low-to-high god that is Kyle Marr. Just that release, man. It just – I love it, man.
It was – he had an incredible game winner. I actually, you know, while we're doling out all this praise, I actually love what I saw from the Delaware offense, too. I didn't know they had bombers. They have bombers on that team. They were sticking corners. They're doing great.
Yeah, I like that Delaware is having a solid season. That one kid, whew, you talk about shooters getting hot. Dude had a high-to-high rocket.
Far pipe.
Yeah. Far pipe. I was like.
And the shot. It's almost like if you have a good crew filming your game, Your team looks better because the angles are better. But yeah, I think it was also an incredible goal.
Yeah, I like that. I like that Delaware is having a solid season, man. All right, next game we've got Maryland 17, Villanova 7.
Dan, for clarification, is 10 goals a mollywopping?
Yeah, probably.
Is it? That's the standard, right?
Yeah. I feel like in the new shot clock era, we might have to up it to 12.
12 to 15. That's fair.
12 to 15.
I'm with you.
Because I feel like, well, there's different grades to this. You know, there's a little bit of a spectrum because there's D1 mollywopping. And as you know, because you are the D2 and D3 podcast guy, there's D2 and D3 mollywopping, which is...
There should be Division 4. Yeah. Yeah, no. I got it. I used to coach Division 4 teams. I know. Trust me.
Seriously, Maryland looked like they were like trying to relegate Villanova to D2 or something. Like this, like a season high in goals for them, and they led big in this game. I think it was like 10-2 at one point. You know, Maryland's attack is pretty good, but they have great balance all over the field. And I would say that even including the Notre Dame loss, that they are playing their best lacrosse in the past three or four games of the season.
I think they're learning important lessons too.
And they're, yeah, you know, we've talked about how there's like four teams that are getting first place votes. Maryland righteously deserves some first place votes, I think. All right, Kyle, another Ivy League tilt we're going to talk about. Penn 19, Princeton 10.
So I know what you're all thinking, but I'm not going to pick on the Princeton D again. I will say that I think Penn might have overtaken UMass as the most underrated team in the nation right now.
That is a quake take.
Wow. That is not in your notes. Congratulations. They have had, you know, Penn has had big wins before in past seasons, but they have gotten them mostly with their defense. And here they are flirting with 20 goals. I like what they're doing over there. And third best team in the Ivy, not awful. Not a bad place to be.
Yeah, this is a really important win in terms of Ivy League seeding. And we go back to Penn, like they were in the Ivy League tournament last year. And that's really going to be important when it comes to the postseason and when we're talking about at-large berths and all that kind of stuff right now. But yeah, Penn, super hot right now. Buy that stock. They excelled on both sides of the ball in this game. And we spoke about how they have really solid defenders. And it certainly showed. They limited Michael Sowers, the first team to really kind of key in on him and kind of stop the crazy output that he's been getting. But you know, Penn's also a team that has a lot of young guys contributing, but they also lean really heavily on some really important seniors in this one. Also, I think there was a goal in this game by Long Stick.
Long pole goal?
Long pole goal. You got to see it.
I love long pole goals.
It was like a dream long pole goal. So you got to check that one out.
Nice.
Kyle, next game we got Vermont 12, UMBC 11 in double overtime.
The Catamounts! I know they're cats, but maybe they howl. Battle of two teams that we thought could be dark horses, and my team won. What's up? What's up now?
Yeah. Seven goal comeback in this one, right?
Yes.
Like that's crazy. Feeling for my Retrievers, man. Just a little bit snake bitten with the injuries this year.
Got to be ready when Fox Force Fifes comes to your town. Wow. Just got to be ready.
All right. Last game we're going to talk about. Sacred Heart 18, Robert Morris 16.
This is actually a really big result. The NEC is a mess right now. We talked briefly pre-pod with Tommy Lyons, formerly of The Mount, and he's a little stressed out. So I think the NEC is really wide open with Bryant dropping a ton of games early, Hobart being kind of the class of the conference at this point. But I think Sacred Heart, you know, building up some momentum, Max Tuttle, you know, getting picked in the MLL draft, Joe East. I think Bobby Moe was the underground team to watch in 2018. Maybe this is a passing of the torch. I think this win signifies that. And Sacred Heart could be in the number two spot in the NEC fighting for a playoff spot.
Yeah, Sacred Heart coming on a little bit strong here. Two really reliable offensive scorers, as you mentioned, Max Tuttle, Joe Seguis. Really big win here. Man, what a year for lacrosse. Even the neck. The neck is interesting, man.
Yeah.
The neck.
You got to protect the neck.
Got to. Wow.
You did that to yourself.
That was not in your notes.
You did that to yourself.
Yeah. All right, Weird Watch of the Week, Kyle. So, damn it.
You're going to get so mad.
Damn. I saw this movie advertised on YouTube, and I was like,
"Yeah,
oh, it's on Netflix.
Oh, it's great. Right?
That looks cool.
Yeah,
and
it's not. What movie are we talking about?
Triple Frontier.
Okay, I watched this Saturday night. Triple Frontier. Like, what? Here's my public service to you, friends. Do not bother to watch this movie. Good points. It was beautifully shot and has a great, albeit on the nose, soundtrack. But the action scenes look like they were cutaways from Burn Notice. For those of you that don't know what Burn Notice is, that's exactly my point. J.C. Chandor, who is the director here, made one good movie with a horrible ending called The Most Violent Year, also with Oscar Isaacs. And this movie somehow has a worse ending. So now we know he's the director that makes movies with bad endings.
So it's not just M. Night Shyamalan.
No, it's not. It's him too. They're both just sitting there in the corner of the diner by themselves drinking coffee. being like, I'll tell you my secret now. So this movie is a Soldier of Fortune movie led by Oscar Isaacs, Ben Affleck, and Charlie Hunnam, who also is maybe the lead. I'm not sure. And neither is the movie. Pedro Pascal is also in this. And inexplicably, Garrett Hedlund, who might be the only dude who tries to give a performance with something other than forlorn eyes and wistful looks. This movie is existential trash. And I'm pissed that everyone is watching it because it's a bunch of dudes with guns on Netflix and all they're doing is stealing money from a drug lord, fighting about the money during their escape, which is somehow the last 45 minutes of the movie. Awful dialogue, paper thin characters, and a boring conclusion. Do not waste your 2 hours. And I'm going to spoil it for you right now so you don't have to. So if you don't want to know the spoiler, click ahead. The twist of the movie is that Ben Affleck dies after he shoots half a dozen people in a village because they get too close to his personal space. And the second twist is that the son of one of the guys he killed comes back at the very end of the movie and shoots him in the head. So when the guys finally escape, they give all their money to Affleck's family and take nothing. There, I've ruined it. Now you can go watch something better. And you know what? I did watch something better. I know it's not my turn, but I'm going to keep going because we talked about this briefly. Yo, how great of a movie is Troy from 2004? That's a full circle. Full circle move. Let's do it.
So this is a... Yeah, Troy is a good movie, man.
Good movie.
And you were watching this during lacrosse games as well? You had like two TVs?
So I had lacrosse on the laptop with my YouTube TV. That's a free plug for YouTube TV. By the way, you should get that. Cut the cord. Next level. So good. And on the TVs here in the office, I had random movies playing. I watched Thor 2, The Dark World. It's not great, but not as bad as everyone says it is. And Troy, while I was watching other games that I had taped.
Yeah, and Troy was like one of those movies that, you know, 2004, probably not appreciated. I watched it like a year ago, maybe 2 years ago. I was like, man, this movie's awesome.
Yeah.
Like the costumes look great. There's a cool cast. They've got great choreography. The action's cool. Everybody seems perfectly casted. Yeah, man, it's cool.
It's great.
It's a great movie. And
throwback.
I said this, and you actually didn't believe me, but I was like, this movie set the table for a show like Game of Thrones.
I mean, you could convince me that. I think Lord of the Rings did that more, but okay.
But also...
Fair.
But the thing is, David Benioff, one of the writers and producers for Game of Thrones, wrote this screenplay. That's why.
So maybe that's why he got the call, though. So that's fair.
Yes.
Okay.
But this movie kicks butt.
Yeah, it's good. Go watch it. I'm sure it's streaming somewhere.
It's not on Netflix? I thought you said it on Netflix.
I wasn't sure. I didn't do any research on The Weird Watch. Sorry. Too much research on other stuff.
But we also said this. Like, this is one of the first movies that I can remember where... Eddard Stark doesn't die. Scene being, baby. He actually comes up with... He's Odysseus, so he comes up with the way that they're going to get into Troy.
This is truly a weird watch since we're talking about a movie from 2004. Just wrecking it. Doing so great with this segment. I love it.
All right, Kyle. Time for our dive rule debate. Or rant, whatever you want to call it. Let's go.
All right. So I mentioned I was going to dip into the D3 a little bit. I'm going to do it again. I saw about 7 dive goals at the Mustang Classic this weekend, and 4 of them included contact with the goalie before the ball went in. All of them were called as pushes from behind and good goals, and on the one that the guy didn't even score but got blasted into the keeper, that was also a push from behind. I feel like I'm complaining about the wrong thing, but is this what we wanted? MLL-style adjudication of the rule? Damn the torpedo people? Because maybe that's the way forward, but I feel like introducing this rule to protect the goalies needs to, I don't know, actually protect the goalie! Maybe. Yeah, I'm here advocating for the safety of goalies. Dan, what has the world come to? What have we become? Who am I? What is happening?
I don't know.
I have one more idea, though. I think it'll fix this a little bit, but it'll cause problems everywhere else.
Okay.
What if the push from behind which is most often called when a defender pushes a ball carrier into the crease and or when said ball carrier is diving, was called as a one-minute penalty. Defenders would have to change how they approach smashing players into the goal mouth to draw a goalie contact penalty, and goalies could have more control on whether or not they want to meet the player diving physically or try to make the save.
Hmm.
What do you think? And it wouldn't be wiped out if it was 1 minute. You would have to serve. What do you think?
That's not bad.
It's not bad. It would change a lot, I think.
We need to try it.
No, let's try it.
Let's test it out and fall ball and stuff like that.
I think they do it at youth. I think someone, I put this on Twitter and someone tweeted at me that they do that in youth. So maybe move it up.
Yeah, man. Give it a try. People hate the dive rule now, I think.
People hate the dive now. We've done it.
We've turned it against them.
Yeah.
Even Lax Film Room is tweeting unpopular opinions. I hate the dive. They're not interesting to watch.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, that is truly an unpopular opinion, because even if it's illegal, it's still interesting to watch.
Yeah. Even if a guy, it's actually more exciting. The play it's most often compared to is dunking in basketball.
No.
It is. No, it is. It's not the same thing, but that's the play it's compared to because of the level of athleticism. I guess everyone could dive, but not everyone can score. Sort of like everyone could try to dunk, but most people can't dunk. I don't know. It doesn't make any sense that it's not exciting, though. I'm sorry. Even if you miss, even if you get messed up, like, it's kind of part of the game. It's kind of exciting. Sorry.
Yeah. All right. Final segment, the Tucker Dordovic play of the week. Now, I know that you watched a teeny amount of lacrosse this weekend.
I watched a lot. My brain hurts. I don't like it.
So, all right, quick aside before we talk about the play, I was following you on social media. Like, it's like 7:30 at night on a Friday, and you're still tweeting out
every
scores
goal
from Mustang Classic.
Every
like,
goal.
He's still going.
My dude.
He's still out there.
I'm always out there.
Is Kyle Devitt a wagon? Is he a wagon?
Don't like antagonize the audience, because half of them listen to the podcast to make fun of me, and the other half might actually like what we're saying, but don't like us or me. They probably like you because you come off very affable.
Well,
you keep your hot takes in your pocket.
Oh yeah,
and I put them out there for the people, so they would like you more. Tucker Dordovic play of the week. Every fast break goal from the RIT Amherst game, all of them. Pick one. There was like 20. Both teams got after it at the Mustang Classic. Maybe the best game I've seen all year in any division. Make sure you tune in to the Inside the Cross D2, D3 podcast the day after you hear this for more details on that. It's lacrosse the way it was meant to be played, total and complete fluidity. Although, it's a D1 podcast. We're going to stick to D1. I got to tell you, Nate Solomon's cutting BTB fake to overhand finish was amazing to me. Absolutely my favorite out of all the goals. I know that seems wild, but the level of skill and audacity to pull a BTB fake that you've caught in the air as you're cutting. Now, he didn't step down. He's cutting, catches it, BTB fakes, goalie bites, and he buries it. Was awesome to me. It's my favorite goal of the weekend.
Kyle.
Yes.
So, St. Patrick's Day, I was out. I went to an Irish pub. We watched the Chelsea-Everton game. My poor Chelsea friend did not like
that
one.
Not a good day for him.
Not a good day for him. And so anyway, I'm kind of getting bored with the game, and I turn on the Syracuse highlights, and I see this goal. And I was like, did he just fake behind the back?
Yeah.
I had to watch it 3 more times. I was like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
He faked behind the back. That is filthy. Get this man, Nate Solomon, a shower, because that is filthy, man. And just watching it, like, it looks cool, but then you think about how brilliant it is.
Yes.
Because it makes Edelman go low and come out, increasing his angle, and then he just literally turns and plops it over him.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that is so next level lacrosse. It's amazing.
I loved it.
That is our Tucker Dordovic play of the week.
So good. So good.
So that game happened in the Carry Dome, and you made some false promises, apparently,
Dome. Why are you doing this?
You must answer for your sins, Kyle.
I shall answer for what do you want me to answer for? That I didn't know that the women's hoops team was getting a game at the Carry Dome? Sorry. My bad. That's my fault. That's my fault.
You were surprised at the virality of your tweet, though.
I was.
Saying that, like this tweet if you want me and Dan to go to the Carry Dome and watch a game.
Yeah.
Because this is the matchup for it. I was like, isn't that game going to be, like, not in the Carry Dome, though?
I mean, I don't know. We'll see.
Kyle, though, I commend you for instead of just deleting or not responding to this news being broken to you in real time.
Yes.
You decide to go with the crying Jordan putting on his hoodie and leaving meme.
Yes.
That's truly one of my favorite moments of Twitter this weekend.
Well, I'm happy I could provide that to you. I did say that we would find a way to maybe get there for Cornell, but that's a Tuesday game, April 9th. Or if they host a playoff game, we'll try and get there and cover that together and do a podcast there. We want to try and make both happen. I can tell you I will not be there this weekend because I have been booked for Merrimack versus LeMoyne.
Boo.
In North End
boo.
Over Matt. I know. Boo me all you want. So that'll be fun. Not as fun as if I was able to see Duke versus Syracuse in the Dome. But again, factors away from our control prevented us from fulfilling that. I will thank all of the people that actually liked the tweet. It was 200 plus people. I've never had so much support for anything I've ever done in my life. Thank you so much. We appreciate it. We'll get there eventually.
All right, everyone. That is our show. For everyone out there listening, you can find me at Dan_Abern on Twitter. If you like what you hear, please tell a friend. Please leave us a nice rating. Kyle, where can they find you?
You can find me at TheKyleDevitt on Twitter. And check out some of our stuff from the Mustang Classic on InsideTheCross.com.
All right. Thank you, guys. We'll see you next week.
Yeet.